You're listening to The Briefing, first broadcast on the 24th of October 2014 on Monocle 24. The Briefing, in association with Park Hyatt. Hello and welcome to The Briefing, coming to you live from Studio One here at Midori House in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. On today's programme...
It was not easy, not at all, but we managed to reach a fair decision. It sets Europe on an ambitious yet cost-effective climate and energy path.
European leaders strike a deal on cutting carbon emissions. We ask, how significant is it and will it be honoured? We'll also be discussing China's launch of a World Bank rival in Asia. Also, international human rights lawyer Jared Genzer reflects on successes and challenges of the responsibility to protect, a norm in international security and human rights.
It's really not about the high-profile public examples of Libya or Syria that one measures success. It's by the averted mass atrocity crimes that actually never took place because you were able to intervene early and through intensive diplomatic, economic, and political engagement.
We'll also take a look at the morning's Latin American front pages with Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Fernando, what do you have for us?
Well, it's election season in Latin America. This week in Brazil and Uruguay, we choose their new presidents. We discuss the latest polls and scandals.
We'll also have the latest business news and a bit of luxury retail, all right here on The Briefing with me, Steve Bloomfield. But before all of that, here's David Spencer with the latest news from around the world.
Thank you, Monocle 24 News. I'm David Spencer. European leaders say a deal struck on cutting greenhouse gases by 2030 is a crucial step forward for Europe. After lengthy talks, an overall target was agreed for the 28-nation bloc to cut its emissions of carbon in 2030 by at least 40% from levels in the benchmark year of 1990. Also in Brussels, EU leaders have called on Britain to accept a demand to increase its contribution into the EU budget. London has criticised the demand, although the likes of the Netherlands and Greece also have to pay more. France and Germany will get a rebate after an annual revision of payments. Finnish Prime Minister Alexander Stubb isn't impressed with Britain's reaction.
I think it's very important that we don't start treating the European Union as some kind of a simplified accounting exercise. Finland has over the years been pretty much a plus minus zero member state. We put in, we get out approximately the same. We're a little bit more on the net contributing side. So is the United Kingdom. Sometimes I think we make mountains out of molehills.
The World Health Organization is sending more experts to help Mali fight Ebola, a day after the first case of the disease was confirmed there. A two-year-old girl who travelled to neighbouring Guinea has been infected, making Mali the sixth West African country affected by the outbreak. In New York, a doctor's tested positive for the virus, the fourth case to be diagnosed in the US. Craig Spencer worked for the charity Médecins Sans Frontières and had just returned to the US after treating patients in Guinea. Tunisian security personnel have killed six people, including five women, after a standoff with an Islamist militant group on the outskirts of Tunis. At least two militants, along with women and children, had been holed up in the house to the west of Tunis. It followed clashes in which one police officer was killed when troops surrounded the building. The incident comes 2 days before a parliamentary election. A group of police officers have been injured in New York by a hatchet-wielding attacker. One was injured critically after they were assaulted as they posed for a photograph. The attacker was shot dead. Police have declined to comment on reports the attack was terror-linked, but the US has been on heightened alert after the double attack in Canada this week, in which two soldiers were killed. Earlier in Washington, White House Press Secretary Josh Earnest had said the US and Canadian national security teams were working closely together.
President Obama yesterday offered Canada any assistance that's necessary in responding to these attacks, and our respective national security teams are coordinating very closely, including again today. As the President said yesterday, when it comes to dealing with terrorist activity, it is clear that Canada and the United States have to be entirely in sync. We have been in the past, and we will continue to be in the future.
Pro-democracy protesters in Hong Kong say they'll hold a vote on government proposals to end 4 weeks of protests. They'll be deciding on reform proposals tabled by senior city government officials in talks on Tuesday that failed to break the deadlock when they were rejected by the protesters. The Swedish military has called off its search for a suspected foreign submarine in waters off Stockholm after a week-long hunt. More than 200 troops, ships and helicopters have been operating since last Friday after reports of foreign underwater activity, suspected to be a Russian submarine. The search was the country's biggest military mobilization since the Cold War. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
David Spencer, thank you very much indeed. 12:05 here in London, 7:05 in New York City. I'm Steve Bloomfield and this is The Briefing. European Union leaders have agreed a deal on a new target to cut carbon emissions by 40% by 2030. That's compared with 1990 levels. The news comes after late-night talks in Brussels at the European Council summit, where states battled, of course, to promote their interests from coal to nuclear power to farming. The deal has been described as a new global standard, but critics say it's not enough. Joining us on the line now is Michael Jacobs, senior advisor at the New Climate Economy and visiting professor at the London School of Economics. Michael Jacobs, welcome to The Briefing. Is this a deal that on paper might be something to celebrate?
Good afternoon. Yes, I think it is. It's not been easy. The European Union is struggling with economic policy, and many people have seen climate change as a distraction from that. What the leaders have done is to say it isn't a distraction. It's actually about the future of the European economy, because it's only an economy that is lower carbon that will actually guarantee prosperity and jobs for Europeans over the coming decades. So that's very important, I think, which is that they've set this in the context of the European economy and how we create more prosperity. And they are. This is the Europe is the first set of countries to set out what their long-term climate commitments are. So this is important not just in Europe, but for the rest of the world, because the rest of the world is looking at Europe and saying, well, you know, they've started to do renewable energy and energy efficiency and so on over the last few years, but are they going to continue this? And this agreement, I think, does say, yes, Europe will continue on this path. It sees prosperity as something that is achieved by going lower carbon, by having cleaner energy and so on. And so in that sense, I think it's important in Europe, but it's also important beyond it.
How difficult or tricky are these sorts of long-term targets? Because we're talking about cutting emissions by 2030. There's not going to be a single European leader who was around that table last night who will still be in office then, or at least we certainly hope so. Is it then a bit difficult to ensure that these things are followed through from one administration to another?
Well, you would think it would be. And in many ways, this is, people have said, you know, you can't deal with climate change because politicians are only there for the short term and it's a long-term problem. But Europe is showing that you can, because what Europe will now do as a result of this agreement is in each country, in a different way in each country, according to national circumstances, will put in place the laws and regulations which will drive emissions down to reach this target. And those will stay in place because they're part of European law. And although individual countries can change their policies, as part of the European Union as a whole, they have committed to doing this all the way through to 2030. So it would take a huge political rupture in order to change that. And so that then tells businesses and tells investors, this is, your money is safe if you put this into low carbon energy and energy efficiency and so on. Policy won't change in the next 3 years' time because the government has changed. This is for the long term, and it makes it much more certain. That makes it cheaper. It's actually easier to raise to borrow and money and so on if you've got long-term certainty. So this is a model in a way for how political systems which run on 4 or 5 yearly political cycles can nevertheless make economic policy which lasts for a long time. So in that sense, I think our politicians have proved that maybe they're not quite as bad as we all tend to think they are. They are willing to do things for the long term and to put in place the mechanisms to make it happen.
Michael, in terms of the lessons that you hope other countries outside of Europe take from this, obviously there'll be a bit of pressure on the United States to try and match this. But is actually the more interesting aspect that the poorer countries in Europe that would still say they are still developing have managed to agree to these measures, something that maybe India, China might look at and say, well, if they can do it, so can we.
Certainly China is ahead of Europe on this in many ways. China, which is experiencing huge economic growth and therefore whose emissions are growing very strongly, has committed to reaching a peak of its global greenhouse gas emissions and then bringing them down within the next decade or decade and a half. So by 2030, by the same period that the EU has now said. So China is already on a path to doing this, and frankly it's much harder for China with its very rapid economic growth than it is for Europe. So yes, the poorer European countries have agreed to this, and they can see why this benefits them. Look, energy efficiency saves us all money. This is good economics. Clean energy is more secure energy. Eastern European countries, which tend to be the poorer ones, they want to escape dependence on Russian gas. So going for a stronger renewables policy and more interconnection between the markets for energy in Europe, these are good things for the poorer countries. And yes, you're right, this does show other countries that they can do it too. So yes, the pressure moves. I think Europe has now said, look, we will continue to take a lead on this. So it is up to China and the US, particularly the US, which has been a laggard in this, although Obama has now made it some kind of commitment of his own, to follow. And this creates a bit of momentum. And we're working now towards Paris, a big conference in Paris in December next year, December 2015, when a new international agreement has to be signed involving all countries, which will put all of this on an international legal footing. And Europe has helped that process by showing that it is possible to go for a more prosperous economy with jobs and also take emissions to reduce your emissions.
Michael Jacobs, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. Michael Jacobs from the New Climate Economy and visiting professor at the London School of Economics. And in a moment, we'll be talking a bit more about China. A new infrastructure bank backed by China has been launched in Beijing, but major nations that were supposed to be part of it did not attend. Australia, Indonesia and South Korea all skipped the launch of the new $50 billion Asia Infrastructure Investment Bank. It aims to give project loans to developing nations, with China set to be its largest shareholder. Delegates from 21 countries, including India, Thailand and Malaysia, were at the launch. The bank is seen as a rival to the World Bank and Western-dominated lenders. Joining us now on the line is Ben Cavender from the China Market Research Group. Ben Cavender, this perhaps was not the sort of launch that China wanted, with a lot of the other big boys staying away.
Yeah, you know, I think all things being equal, they would have preferred to see a few developed countries sign on to this as well, but I think they probably kind of got the reception they expected. I think the Chinese realized that, you know, putting this development bank into practice, what they're essentially doing is extending their soft power across the region. So it's not really a surprise that countries like the United States or Australia or South Korea would maybe not be so keen on joining into this, simply because they worry it's a way for China to exert a little bit more influence in the region.
And Ben, this isn't, you know, the only big international bank that China's launched recently, or been part of launched recently. Of course, there was the BRICS have put together their new development bank, which again is supposed to be a way for the other countries outside of the West to try and increase their influence. What do you think the goal is of both this new Asia Infrastructure Investment Bank and the new development bank in terms of changing the balance of economic power?
Well, I think that the ultimate goal here is to, you know, extend these companies' economic and political power globally. I think that if you're China, for example, or any of the other BRICS nations, you're looking at how you maintain economic growth going forward. And this is actually a great vehicle for that, because it cements ties with potential trade partners. It also gives you a vehicle to hopefully sell contracts to construction companies and infrastructure-based companies as well that could then help to develop some of these regions. And I think that there is a place for banks like this. I mean, if you look at the World Bank or the Asian Development Bank, they do a pretty good job, but there's a lot of red tape that you've got to cut through in order to get loans from either one of those organizations. So there's potential here if these countries get it right with this new infrastructure bank or the BRIC bank, to actually make lending a little bit easier and sort of give access to capital in some of these developing countries that really do need it to sort of improve roads or telecom or some other infrastructure.
Ben, it's not just people in the West who have concerns necessarily about loans that China makes. It's also democracy activists or civil rights activists in countries which have received loans from China in the past, because there tends to be absolutely no strings attached whatsoever. If you're in Angola, Angola has turned down IMF loans that would have seen proper political reforms take place, and instead taken loans from China where they can do whatever they want.
Yeah, you know, I think this is the big concern here, and I think when you see who hasn't signed on, in many cases, this is what they're worried about. If you take Africa, the model, what you've seen from China on kind of a repeated basis is they'll extend loans in return for concessions for natural resources, but what happens is they'll send in their own construction people to build the roads, and the local economy never really develops because local people don't get any skills development, and much of the projects end up not really being sustainable in the long term. So I think the fear here is that this is kind of a proxy for China to continue doing what it's doing, but maybe in a way that sort of masks what's actually happening. So I think what everybody's going to be looking for is, you know, what's the governance structure here? What are the terms that are going to be attached to loans? How transparent is the whole process going to be? And I think if they can prove that the process is transparent and that there's going to be oversight and that there will be at least some strings attached, this could be very good. But if they can't do that, then ultimately it's probably going to be sort of destined for failure and not really do that well in the long run.
Ben Cavender, we'll leave it there. Thank you very much for joining us on The Briefing. Up next, we'll wrap up our series on the responsibility to protect.
For those with exquisite taste, luxury is not necessarily easy to define. Rather, for many, luxury is a collection of simple pleasures and uncommon indulgences, particular to each and every one of us. What's on the luxury list in the city that never sleeps? Chef's table at the back room at 157. A private tour of MoMA. Dark chocolate truffles. Backstage access at Carnegie Hall. Discover your own journey of rare and intimate experiences at more than 30 exquisite hotels worldwide. Park Hyatt. Luxury is personal.
Global affairs, culture, business, design, or urbanism. At Monocle 24, we've got it covered. And when it comes to transport and travel, you need look no further. From automobile innovators to the creative minds shaping the in-flight experience, we speak to the experts to ensure you have all the industry news you'll ever need. In New York, our transport editor, Tristan McAllister.
Whether it's a closer look at the global aviation heavyweights or embedding with the people who keep Alaska State Ferry System afloat, we take you to the people and the places that make our world move.
Take to the skies, the rails, the seas, or the roads with Monocle 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
You're listening to The Briefing here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. 1918 in Hong Kong, 1218 here in London, and 718 on the East Coast. Time now for the last episode in this week's series on the responsibility to protect, a norm that emerged as the world said never again to the genocides and conflicts of the 1990s. The idea, the duty to protect populations from mass atrocities that love lies above all with the state. But if a state fails to protect its people, the international community should use appropriate means to do so. That norm was agreed on at the 2005 UN World Summit. Monocle's Alice Block spoke to international human rights lawyer Jared Gentzer, who explained how R2P, as it's known, has evolved and made its mark.
the responsibility to protect has had an important impact. The problem is that people perceive it as being only the blunt-edged sword of military intervention, and that's really a very small percentage of what it is about. People see, you know, wrongly, I believe, Libya as a high watermark for the responsibility to protect, where there was an intervention to protect a civilian population in Benghazi, and the deadlock over Syria as a failure of the responsibility to protect. But neither of those assessments is actually fair or accurate. The responsibility to protect has worked quite nicely in countries like Kenya and Guinea and Liberia and a range of other places where major conflicts were potentially going to be undertaken. And it's also been really embraced by the international community across the board, even though, of course, there might be disagreement on how it's implemented.
Well, speaking of successes, here's Ban Ki-moon in early 2012 talking about the successes and the challenges of the norm.
We gave hope to people long oppressed in Libya, Cote d'Ivoire, South Sudan, Yemen, and Syria by our words and actions. We demonstrated that human protection is a defining purpose of the United Nations in the 21st century.
Jared, which of those cases there cited by Ban Ki-moon do you see as a good example of RTP in action?
They are both examples of successes as well as ongoing failures. But, you know, I would say, for example, looking at Syria, there's no doubt the responsibility to protect applies. However, the machinery of the UN was built to allow for a veto of permanent members of the Security Council. So it is actually not a failure of R2P, but a failure of the UN architecture, in my view, that has prevented meaningful engagement on Syria. I think if you look to a number of those examples, if you look to South Sudan, if you look to Cote d'Ivoire, you see low-profile examples where there hasn't been a lot of international attention, but where direct engagement by the international community early on in the form of diplomacy and serving as a bridge between warring parties has resulted in greater peace and stability being provided to those areas. Both countries have ongoing problems and challenges, as do others mentioned by the Secretary General. But it's actually, you know, much like a proverbial iceberg where 80% of it is underwater or 90% is it underwater. I would say that that is actually how one should evaluate the responsibility to protect. It's really not about the high profile public examples of a Libya or Syria that one measures success. It's by the averted mass atrocity crimes that actually never took place because you were able to intervene early and through intensive diplomatic, economic, and political engagement. So it's hard to measure the success of a non-mass atrocity crime situation, but that's actually how one needs to look at the success of R2P.
And staying in the present day, actually, here's the spokesman for the UN Secretary General speaking at a press briefing last month.
This morning, the Secretary General spoke at the Interactive General Assembly discussion on the responsibility to protect, saying that the commitment is being severely tested today. He said the world faces a series of conflicts that feature acts that shock the global conscience, from the horrors unfolding in Iraq and Syria to persistent violence against civilian populations in South Sudan, the Central African Republic, Ukraine, Northern Nigeria, Pakistan, Gaza, and elsewhere. The Secretary General said it is no longer tenable to turn a blind eye to such situations. Our responsibility to prevent and protect is collective and urgent.
Jared, that is obviously an awfully long list, sadly. Is it harder to protect populations than ever before? And where do you see the responsibility to protect heading in the future?
Well, you know, what I would say is that it is a long list of countries where the international community is coming up short and where victims are facing a whole range of mass atrocity crimes, including genocide, war crimes, ethnic cleansing, and crimes against humanity. There's no doubt that that's the case and continues to be the case. I think that the differences in the 21st century with globalization and a global media, that we're much more aware of ongoing developments in these situations in real time, and therefore they should demand our urgent attention. And yet at the same time, many of these conflicts are intractable and longstanding and based on historical and deep-seated, you know, ethnic, religious, or other disputes. And as a result, it's very, very difficult to bring these disputes to an end. In addition, resources are highly limited, particularly in countries that are in the midst of major conflict. And therefore, you know, to mobilize global attention and concern, to pour resources into these situations, to stem the violence, and to try to negotiate resolved outcomes remains a major challenge. The reality is the amount of money that's being dedicated to any of these situations mentioned by the Secretary General is a small fraction of really what would be required to get the job done well.
That was Monocle's Alice Block talking to international human rights lawyer Jared Genzer, co-editor of The Responsibility to Protect, The Promise of Stopping Mass Atrocities in Our Time. You're listening to The Briefing. Up next, Stats with Ben. Well, 24 here in London, 8:24 in Buenos Aires, and Ben Page from Ipsos Mori joins us now with his weekly look at the world of statistics. And Ben, we were talking a little bit about the European Union earlier in the show and how actually they seem to be doing a good job when it comes to the issue of climate change. People in Britain have not necessarily always been big fans of the EU. You've got some research, I believe, on whether Britain is falling in love or out of love with the European Union at the moment.
Yes, I mean, the thing about the British and the European Union is that they've never been in love with it, and their relationship with it is pretty pragmatic. But interestingly, we've been asking about feelings about staying or going in Europe, in the United Kingdom, for the last 40 years, and we currently have one of the highest levels of support, actually, for continuing, 56%, which was a bit of a surprise, because for people listening who've been following British politics, the main story of the last year or so has been the rise of the UK Independence Party, one of whose main arguments, of course, is that we should get out as quickly as possible, and they are now polling at record levels, albeit around 15%. But I think what it shows is a polarization of debate in Britain, and in some ways a silent majority who may be more sympathetic to the European Union, if rather grudgingly, than the very vocal people who get a lot of media coverage about leaving.
Mm. Now, Ben, I have a theory on this.
Okay. And
okay, he says with a tone of voice, which is that while Nigel Farage may be a good media figure and obviously has a certain level of support, he also, let's face it, is not well loved by a number of people. And with him as the public face of getting out of Europe, that might persuade many people that actually staying in is not a bad thing.
I think that's possibly true, because what we have, when we look at the leaders of the main political parties in Britain, one of the things that's most clear is that people agree that the UK Independence Party is different to all the other parties, but they're also most likely to be seen as extreme by a country mile, and he is a polarising figure. The other thing I'd say is that we've just asked some questions that we last asked that go right back to 1969 as a time series, and what's interesting there is that despite all of this hoo-ha about whether Britain's stays or leaves the European Union, we have a record number of people saying that Europe is the place that matters most to Britain. It's up from 21% back in 1969 to 34%. And America and the Commonwealth have drifted downwards. So, you know, although there's a fraction of British society that wants to leave, most people, again, seem to be pragmatic and recognising that we need to stay close to our largest trading partner.
Now, I believe you've also been doing some research on, and I'm not entirely sure how you come up with these ideas, on which country is the most sexist.
Well, what we've done is look at a number of, this is part of our global trend study that we do each year, and we've asked 400 questions of 20,000 people around the world. And we've asked people about just the role of women in society. So we've asked, you know, what about the proposition that women should stay at home and be good wives and mothers in the traditional model? Do you think that's a good idea? Overall in the world, 6 out of 10 people disagree. In Britain, it's 68% who disagree. In Sweden, of course, very much more liberal sort of place, 88% disagree. But there's one country that's persistently likely to think that women really should get out of business and just stay at home, and that's Russia. 73% of the Russian population that we've surveyed, including men and women, think that women should stay at home. And when we come up with the proposition that things would work better if women had more power in both business and in government, again, across the planet, the majority of just 53%, there is a split by gender, but it's not 100%, say that's true. With places like, interestingly, Italy and Turkey, 68% there, both think that would be a good idea. In Russia, no, yet. Only 38% of people in Russia would go along with that. And of course, the majority of people in Russia, as in most countries, are women.
Ben, is this something that you've asked before? I mean, can you see sort of historically how this is changing over time?
We have for some countries, and basically the people who hold this view, certainly in the developed world, in Australasia and everywhere, and you know, Europe and America, they tend to be old and are gradually dying out. And one of the things about views in terms of having, I suppose, old-fashioned views on homosexuality or the role of women is that when we plot and look at how views break down by different age groups in society, because the people who were born before the end of the Second World War will eventually all die out, as indeed will my generation in the end, but because of that, and because there are such big differences by age groups, we can predict that by the early 2020s, some of these views will seem very archaic indeed.
Ben Page from Ipsos Mori, thank you very much indeed, as ever. You're listening to The Briefing here on Monocle 24. In the next half hour, we'll have the latest business headlines from Pim Fox over at Bloomberg in New York. We'll also look at the latest luxury retail news. Faye will be here with the Latin American papers. But first, here's David Spencer with the headlines.
Thank you very much indeed. EU leaders have called on the United States and China to follow their lead by agreeing to step up the battle against carbon emissions over the next 15 years. The EU has set new targets for 2030 after long and often difficult talks. British Prime Minister David Cameron has challenged a demand from the European Union for an additional €2.1 billion payment into the EU budget. The demand comes after a revision of economic statistics. Mali has confirmed its first case of Ebola, becoming the sixth West African country to be affected by the outbreak. The patient is a two-year-old girl who's recently arrived from Guinea. Meanwhile, a doctor who worked with Ebola patients in Guinea is in an isolation unit in New York City after testing positive for the virus. Amnesty International says police in the US state of Missouri should be investigated for human rights abuses. It's issued a report into the handling of protests in Ferguson that erupted after the police killing of an unarmed black teenager in August. Russia's top bank has launched a legal challenge in a European Union court over Western sanctions. They've been imposed because of Moscow's involvement in the Ukraine crisis. And a new China-backed infrastructure bank has been officially launched, but Australia, Indonesia and South Korea missed the event. The bank is seen as a challenge to the World Bank and Asian Development Bank. Those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
David Spencer, thank you very much indeed. 12:31 here in London, 7:31 in New York City. Let's cross there right now, where Pim Fox from Bloomberg is standing by. Pim, welcome to The Briefing. Let's begin with Amazon, the huge behemoth, the giant when it comes to online shopping and retailing. They've killed all the bookstores. They've made lives misery for writers. They've made huge amounts of money, but they're struggling now, aren't they?
Yeah, well, that seems, well, I don't know, you know, struggling is in the land of the internet, it seems to be, right? You can't really figure these things out. I mean, how is it possible that because of one report, the company loses, I don't know, $10, $15 billion worth of its current value? But here's the deal. 3 months ago, Amazon was expected to lose 7 cents a share in the third quarter. Then they warned that they were investing so heavily in so many things. I don't know, it must be all those drones, perhaps. But instead of losing 7 cents, they ended up losing 74 cents. So this is not good. They reported that it lost 95. The 74 cents is the projection that they came out with. Everyone was looking for that, as I said, the 7 cents. They come out and they say, oh, no, we're going to lose 74 cents. Everyone goes, okay, that's right. We can take that. And then what happens yesterday after the market closes? They said, no, in fact, we lost 95 cents. Ooh, very bad. More disappointing news. Sales, $250 billion less than everyone was looking for. A company also says it might lose money in the fourth quarter, which of course includes that all-important holiday shopping season. The growth in sales is fading. The company said that sales is going to rise between 7 and 18% in the fourth quarter. Well, last time I checked, you can drive a truck between 7 and 18. So that's not really very helpful. Last year, revenue in the fourth quarter rose 20%. So you're getting a little bit of a look into the way Amazon is operating. The stock down 10% yesterday after the news came out. They continue to spend money on a variety of different products.
I mean, this is it, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's that they are spending, you know, a lot of money. They've invested in many different things. I mean, their stock is still, you know, at, you know, almost $280. You know, so
yes.
It's this is no, you know, this is no small company.
Right. I mean, and this has been the thing, right? I mean, if I can convince you to buy something because of the shade of blue, and someone else says, well, you know, I can get the same thing in red, and you go, well, no, I really want it in that shade of blue. Well, everyone has been saying, you know, investors have been saying, you know, I really love the shares of Amazon because they keep showing this phenomenal 20% growth rate, and I don't really care how much money it loses as long as they're investing in these very smart things like Kindle Fires and mobile phones and...
Well, I mean, you mentioned the Fire on the mobile phone, but it hasn't done that well, has it? I mean, it was supposed to be, the Fire phone was supposed to be, you know, its big entry into the smartphone market. It hasn't really taken off, has it?
You mean you have never met anybody that has one?
Absolutely haven't. Not a single
person.
Okay,
I can't find anybody other than people in the press who have been given these things. I haven't been able to find anybody that actually has an Amazon phone.
It feels a bit like the BlackBerry playbook.
Well, I'm going to I'll let that one just pass out into the, you know, slipstream of history. But, okay, so here's what they've been spending money on. They've been spending money on a fight with Hachette because they don't necessarily want to pay the margins that Hachette, the French book publisher, wants them to pay in order to carry their books. What else are they spending money on? They're spending money on something called Fire TV. That was introduced in the spring, and it's turned into that streaming box. They're investing in a grocery delivery service that is already expanded to, of all places, Brooklyn, because, of course, you know, you can't get groceries in Brooklyn. Amazon bought Twitch. This is a streaming site to help gamers do more time, you know, waste more time online playing games against each other. So, you know, they also are funding various television. Well, we don't call them television anymore, right? It's now all media series.
But we see it as television. Now, Pim, has all this coalesced into concerns about Jeff Bezos? Are there, you know, he's bought the Washington Post. Is there a feeling that maybe he's taking his eye off the ball, isn't as focused on the day-to-day anymore?
No, doesn't. Well, could be, maybe, doesn't. Let me. I'm getting to the doesn't matter part, which is doesn't matter. Guy owns 35% of the shares. I mean, he owns a company. It's his company. I mean, he is running it. No one's. I mean, there is no call on the part of any investor to pull the plug on any of these ventures. I mean, think about it, right? I mean, we've gone through the. I think they spent what, $2 billion with a B, $2 billion to maybe $2.5 billion on content. I don't know about you, but I'm sure that there are people that somewhere say that they're going to watch this stuff. I haven't met them. I haven't met the people that have bought the phones, but you know, investors typically have been giving Jeff Bezos and Amazon a pass. The company has never made money. I mean, that's like just one of the basic understandings of this kind of investment. It plows whatever cash that they make right back into the business, and the banks and the shareholders are willing to look the other way in the hopes of future profits.
And do you think they'll continue to look the other way?
Well,
at some stage, surely you have to say, you know what, I've invested in this, I'd like some return.
Yeah, you know, the only problem with that, but the only kind of, you know, philosophical dilemma is that the money that you're investing in Amazon, if you're a fund manager, typically is not your own money. So you aren't really making that bet with your own hard-earned cash. You're making that bet with other people's money. And we know that when you use OPM, sometimes it doesn't end up being A-OK. So right now, I think people give him a pass. The stock is down before the market open. I think it's down about another $5 a share. So
we'll see how that opens.
Yeah,
we'll see how that plays out. Pim, just briefly, I want to turn to one company that is undisputably doing well. GM profits have nearly doubled.
Can you understand this? The profits at GM double, right? It's but at the same time, they have all these recalls. I mean, they incurred $700 million in the quarter for fixing recalled vehicles. They have
but people still want to buy them.
Yeah, they've already run up more than $3 billion in charges in the first half for safety problems. But as you just said, people want to buy them. They even posted a relatively routine quarterly report under Mary Barr. They warned that they got more work to do to repair their tarnished reputation. And as you just said, people still buy them. Now you've got this airbag issue, not only with GM, but with a variety of automobile makers. The airbags made by Takata, the Japanese company, they deploy, but when they deploy, they shoot bits of shrapnel into your head. We're talking
that doesn't
about.
Sound too good.
No. And so, you know, one of the points is get your airbag checked.
There
everybody.
We are. Okay, we'll leave it on that note. Pim Fox, thank you very much indeed. You're listening to The Briefing. We have papers from Latin America up next.
My name is Alex Preston. I'm a novelist. Luxury is the absence of necessity. It's the ability to dwell over books, to chase down fugitive thoughts, to travel without giving heed to direction. Luxury is lightness. It's effortless. It's the victory of the beautiful over the necessary.
Park Hyatt. Luxury is personal. Explore more than 30 exquisite hotels worldwide at parkhyatt.com.
What designs will you be wearing next season? How will architecture change the face of your city? And which redesign will affect the paper you pick up?
It's very strange. It's like two triangles and two squares more. But I think that's a stimulus for the architect.
The kerning can take 5 times as long as actually designing the letter forms, which seems fairly brutal.
Is it going to perform? Is it going to stay the same? Is it going to be the same? That's normal anxiety.
Good design improves our lives. If you want to find out how, join me, Monocle's design editor, Tom Morris, every Tuesday on Monocle 24.
Well, 12:41 here in London, at 8:41 in Sao Paulo. You're listening to The Briefing here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. And we're going to be talking about Sao Paulo. Indeed, the rest of Brazil. Fernando Augusto Pacheco is with us, and he has some front pages from Brazil, from Uruguay, and also a weekly magazine in Brazil we're going to look at. Faye, hello.
Hello, Steve.
One big story in Brazil, isn't there?
Exactly. And what an election, especially for journalists, I have to say, Steve, because, you know, the polls keep changing all the time, basically, you know. So today, let's talk about Folha de São Paulo first. You know, they have the latest polls and, you know, they're saying actually Dilma is ahead, which is interesting because just a week ago, Aécio was ahead. So she's had like, she has 52% of the vote against 47 of Aécio Neves.
Now, how confident are Brazilians in opinion polls?
Well, we had a little problem in the first round because they got a lot of things wrong. For example, especially for the elections of governors in the state. For example, one poll saying that the opposition candidate would win and the other one won first round. So, I mean, there are some issues here as well. Mm. But they usually respected, you know, Datafolha and Ibope. But, you know, I think they have to deal how they do this poll, especially in such a vast country.
Indeed. And Brazil. I wonder as well, because, you know, everyone loves a poll, particularly on the front of a newspaper. They can drive the news. And, obviously, if you are struggling for a splash, for a big story, but if you've got a poll, then you've got a splash. There is then a tendency to perhaps put stuff out there that maybe you're not 100% sure on.
Exactly. And it's interesting because, you know, I've been looking for São Paulo the whole week. I think they did 3 polls this week, you know. So, and there'll be another one tomorrow afternoon as well. So, I mean, there's quite a lot.
We'll
but we're not as modern as the Americans. We don't have, you know, their kind of, you know, techniques, because I think they're quite precise.
Indeed. Now, of course, the thing that I find striking about this is that this election's on Sunday. There's still one more debate to go, isn't there?
And the most important one, because it's on Globo, which is, you know, of course, the main TV channel in Brazil. And, you know, it can change an election. I remember in 89, but you know, in 89, you know, there was debate between Lula and Fernando Collor, and they were really kind of neck to neck. But then Globo, they actually edited the debate because at that time it wasn't live. Mm. Now it is live because exactly because of what happened in 89, because they made Collor sings like they only choose the best phrases of Collor and the worst phrases of Lula in a way. So
yeah, Brazilian democracy has developed somewhat since that in a generation.
Exactly. Well, it's interesting, Steve, because I'm talking that Dilma is ahead, you know, and she's doing well, especially among women and the poorest in Brazil. But the thing is, there was a scandal that just, you know, let's talk about, you know, I know we do newspapers here, but I want to talk about a weekly magazine, Veja, which is the best-selling magazine in the country, and it's very right-wing. And it's funny, Steve, because they're usually published on Saturdays, but just because of the election, they decided to actually publish the magazine today. And as you can see on the cover, it's a very frightening cover between, there's Dilma and Lula, which are former Brazilian president, saying they knew everything. So basically, they waited until the very last minute because, you know, there was a guy who was involved in the Petrobras scandal, Alberto Youssef.
Yes. So this is the suggestion that actually Dilma and Youssef, and Lula knew everything about what was going on in the Petrobras
exactly.
scandal.
And it's interesting because they had the audio from Alberto Youssef, which is, you know, he was involved in this scandal and he's in jail since March this year. And they were waiting until before the election to release this cover. And it's quite interesting because there was quite a strong reaction in social media against that as well.
Yes.
And it's very funny, actually.
So these other covers, we've got like a series of other covers of Veja. They are mock-ups from social media.
Like, I love the first one. For example, the man didn't go to the moon. It was a creation of João Santana, which is the marketing, the guy responsible for the marketing campaign of Dilma Rousseff.
Okay.
And, you know, I don't know if you watch Breaking Bad, but it says, you know, Walter White confessed Lula and Dilma were involved in the scandal. So, I mean, it's quite funny because the magazine, even though it sells quite a lot among some segments of Brazilian society, it's not very respected.
Okay. We will see what happens on Sunday. Obviously, we're going to have more on the Daily tonight and obviously on the Globalist at 6 a.m. London time. We'll have a lot of analysis and hopefully the result. There's going to be one other election in Latin America over the weekend, isn't there, Fernando?
Exactly. And, you know, let's talk about El Observador, which is the Uruguayan daily. And, you know, it's interesting, Steve, that the Uruguayan election is a bit similar to the Brazilian one. You know, they have, you know, José Mujica, the current president, is very popular, but of course he can't be re-elected according to the Uruguayan law. But his candidate, even though he's first on the post, Tabaré Vázquez, I don't think he's going to win on the first round. And I believe the dispute is going to the second round on the 30th of November. So, and it's interesting because they have Lacalle Pou from the opposition. He's a young center-right modernizer. He's getting like 28% of the post. And, you know, if the dispute goes to the second round, I think it's going to be very neck-to-neck. And it's going to be a very interesting election because there's a certain part of the middle class in Uruguay, especially in the capital, Montevideo as well, that, you know, kind of they respect what the Frente Ampla did with Mujica and now Tabaré Vázquez, but I think they want change. They want someone to take care of the middle-class interests as well.
Mm. And when it comes to the rest of Latin America, you know, if you can look ahead to what the papers on Monday morning might be outside of Brazil and outside of Uruguay, it's going to be the Brazilian election that dominates, isn't it?
Absolutely. And it's going to be an interesting reaction. For example, I want to talk about La Nación, one of the main Argentinian papers. They did an editorial today supporting Aécio Neves. They're saying that it's going to be a good change for the country without populist measures, you know, and it's going to bring more modernity to the continent.
Is that something that Brazilians will be particularly happy about, seeing you know, newspapers in other countries taking such a strong stance on their election?
No, we're very protective. You know, The Economist did the same with Aécio Neves and a lot of people were angry about that. Well, not Aécio Neves supported, I have to say.
Indeed. Okay, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, thank you very much indeed. As I say, you'll hear more from Fernando on Monday morning's Globalist when we round up all those elections from the weekend, but particularly in Brazil. Faye, for now, thank you very much indeed. You're listening to The Briefing here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. You're listening to The Briefing here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. Now, have a little listen to this.
Just like me, They long to be close to you.
There we are, Close to You, sung by Karen Carpenter. But imagine, if you can, that performed by a humanoid. That's what happened this week when a robot took to the stage in Tokyo as part of a programme of events organised by the city's University of the Arts. From a distance, apparently, the singer looked rather regular. But up close, she was a mere machine, moving her head and syncing to a voice track. Not unlike them, perhaps, many of today's real-life pop stars. One witness told the Japan Times, "I knew that she wasn't really looking at us, but I felt like she was." Monocle's culture editor Robert Bound is now here in studio.
I just love the fact that they played in The Carpenters Close to You. I think whenever I come on as a guest, I want that to be my walk-on music. I think it's great. And what a terrifying story this is. And it is a bit, it's something a bit akin to the girls with the machine guns in their breasts in the Austin Powers
in
movie.
In Austin Powers.
And the actual Karen Carpenter about this. I mean, I think it's one of those things, if you take that much to Mazapan, you can become a
humanoid
weird,
robot
you
singing
can.
Jazz.
Exactly. And it brings up lots of interesting discussions, possibly, doesn't it, Steve? This this kind of weird, well, you know, a robot miming along to a song. We were unsure when we picked up this news story this morning whether or not it was a robot singing, but it's actually
turned out to be a robot miming.
And I wonder what the difference is. The thing is, they've made this robot look like a human in order for it to be a convincing front of a sort of jazz band, an open air jazz band, whatever. I think they're doing American standards and things, aren't they? So it's a strange thing. What is the difference between this, I wonder, and a drum machine? Because a drum machine doesn't look like a drum kit with a sort of robot, you know, like Wall-E or something, or Short Circuit.
Maybe drum machines doing the Phil should Collins, look like that, you know. Now.
Yeah, exactly. I wonder if drum machines in the future will look like a robot actually playing the drums, or whether they just, you know, cut to the chase and make a noise like drums. That's the thing.
What does this tell us about Japan? Because this is it's one of those sort of weird stories about Japan.
We've got 10 minutes. What does this tell us about Japan? Let's go.
But
for
it's one of those sort of weird stories that occasionally come out of Japan. A sort of that mix of a bit strange and super hot technology.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing. I think that actually this, I'm having done a little bit of research into this. On the face of it, this does look like a sort of it could be a TV feature on the Clive James show in the 1980s. Going, look at these guys, aren't they strange? But actually, I think this the scientist that has built this robot is in tune with a. To use the word advisedly, in tune with an Italian technical and cultural institute in Palermo, and they're doing this thing together to sort of talk about to investigate the idea of consciousness and AI and all this kind of stuff. So that's the idea of it, and of course it's a good headline grabbing thing, but I suppose it is about the believability of a robot performing a human's actions, and I suppose it poses the question as we're asking whether if we're listening to so much recorded music, so many people mime on TV music shows, of which there are none now in the UK, but I'm sure in other territories across the world there are some, where people famously mime, like Top of the Pops, etc., which we had on in the UK for over 40 years. What's the difference maybe in having a robot doing it? Would you rather a pitch-perfect rendition of a famous pop song by a robot, or the actual singer turning up and miming along to a track? That's presumably the question. And I think I'd rather have, you know, Katy Perry doing neither.
I mean, the other option is perhaps you have the pop star up there singing properly and not singing that well.
Not singing pitch perfectly.
Is there an argument that this is the best of both worlds? It's a live performance, and yet it's also absolutely perfect.
That's an interesting sense. Also strange is the fact that this has come from the land of karaoke. I know this is something that you rolled your sleeves up and did with anger last week.
Not anger.
Well, did it in anger, as in did it with seriousness.
Yeah.
And you know, this is strange. I think that Japan's got to get its priorities straight. Either it wants to be a drunk businessman in a nightclub belting out, you know, belting out the Carpenters, or it wants to be a robot miming perfectly to it. And I guess only time will tell.
There we are. Only time will tell. Robert Bound, who is doesn't need a robot to sing. You can sing all on his own.
You can.
Thank you very much indeed. You're listening to The Briefing here on Monocle 24. It is at 12:53 here in London, 7:53 in New York City. You're listening to The Briefing with me, Steve Bloomfield. Before we finish the show, we'll wrap up with a look at the big luxury retail news of the week. And in fact, we're going to start with more luxury than retail. We have Sagra Massera DeRozan with us on the line. And Sagra, let's begin by talking about the opening of the Frank Gehry Louis Vuitton Museum.
I mean, this has been a pretty good week for luxury, with lots of news. But and the opening of the Louis Vuitton Museum, I think, is a real highlight that it continues to show the relationship between art and luxury.
What is it about this Louis Vuitton Museum that you think will particularly appeal to people?
Well, I think that the building, to start with, is amazing. It's designed by Frank Gehry, who has also done the Guggenheim in Bilbao, for example. So it's a real, real standout piece of architecture. And then it's going to have a permanent collection, which will include works from Bernard Arnault, who's the chairman and majority shareholder of LVMH, which owns Louis Vuitton. And I think it will show amazing art. I mean, it's a little bit what, you know, Pinault, his art rival in the French of world of luxury, François Pinault, has been doing for several years now in terms of supporting art with his own foundation. Both in Venice and also in Paris and all over the world. All his brands are very, very associated with art.
One other story I want to get your views on today is the fact that Farrow and Ball, who, as anyone who has tried to paint a room recently will know, will be the sort of thing you go, yes, well, should we get the paint from Farrow and Ball? Oh, it's quite expensive. Let's go for it. They're better. Farrow and Ball is up for sale. Who do you think is, what sort of organisation or company is going to be interested in buying them?
Well, right now it's owned by a private equity firm. And I think the companies that are looking at it are also private equity firms. And I think it's very interesting that there is such a strong interest for a company like Farrow and Ball, which is, you know, a paint company, but it amazingly is being able to develop a phenomenal brand, actually global brand, in the world of interiors for something that is relatively mainstream, as a wall paint. What I understand is that there are like two key major private equity firms in the running for the kind of final bids. One is Bain Company and the other one is Carlyle, which are again among the best in the world. I think what this has to make us think about whether luxury interiors and luxury homeware are going to be really important in the following and next few years for luxury goods companies, for private equity firms as well.
And I guess the important thing here is that whoever buys it, they need to ensure that Farrow & Ball's reputation remains, that the quality remains, that this is still seen as, you know, an English manufacturer of paints, that they still use the same techniques, that they still have the same standards.
Yes, and I think they will do that. I mean, I think these guys use it. What they provide is capital for growth. I know that Farrow & Ball wants to expand, particularly internationally. I mean, they're already in the United States and in some European countries, but they're a relatively small company, so there is much to do for them on the international front and getting that support and that investment from one of the major private equity groups in the world will help them really become a truly global interiors firm.
Sagra Massera DeRozan, thank you very much indeed. That brings us to the end of this edition of The Briefing here in London. The Briefing was produced by Alice Block, researched by Gaia Lutz and Amanda Valmabida. The studio manager was Joel Church. Fernando Augusto Pacheco will be back in this very seat to bring you The Atlantic Shift. That is up next, right after the news. The Briefing is back back on Monday, the same time. It's 12 noon here in London, 7 a.m. In fact, no, the clocks have changed. It'll be 8 a.m. In New York City. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.